Hello, my friends. Today we are talking to Rob, the CEO of Ekata, and we discuss autonomous teams that operate within their own envelope, advice for CTOs making the transition to CEO, and actionable steps that you can take to sell your ideas to an executive team. All of this right here, right now on the Modern CTO Podcast.
Here we go.
This is the Modern CTO Podcast.
Hello.
How are you? These are only my reading glasses, but I can see you better with them on. So since it's not, since we're not video recording, I'm just going to keep them on.
You look beautiful, my friend.
I had to give into these about a year and a half ago, and within like 2 weeks, I was completely dependent on them.
Well, you look smart. Like, I trust you more.
Hey, man, I need all the help I can get on that front. So I'm going to wear these things night and day now.
You start wearing glasses, your income goes up, people start treating you differently. Life is good. All because of $5 glasses when you're checking out of Walgreens.
Exactly.
Who would have thought? Where are you calling in from today?
Seattle.
Ooh, is it rainy there?
Not now. It actually is seasonally colder than normal, but not wet. So we'll take it.
All right. You got family? What do you have going on in your personal life? Jumping right into it.
A lot, man. I got three kids. I'm getting ready to cook a bird. We got some family coming in for Thanksgiving. Right.
I'm gonna show you this. This is brand new. How old are your kids?
They're all teenagers, which means they're very cynical. Two of the three of them, I get more grief back from them. I made a mistake when they were very young. They didn't understand sarcasm to be sarcastic with them, and now they're so sarcastic with me, it's frightening.
Look at this technology. So this is like the daycare. They text you like every 2 hours a picture of them, and it's like detailed what they're doing, what they ate, how much they ate, diaper changes. Is that not insane?
All right, so I'm gonna give you another example here. So understand that I have to travel internationally quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I'm over in Europe. We got two offices in Europe. So I'm over there like 3-4 times a year. And I can't find the examples, but basically I get texts every day from the dog walker. And so, I'm trying to tell people, like, back in my day, we would get a Eurail pass, and it'd be like, we didn't have any mobile phones. It'd be like, hey, we'll see it in 3 weeks, in 3 days, the Amsterdam train station track 11 between 10 and 11 a.m. If you're not there, it's the next day, same place. Otherwise, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Like, that was how it worked back then, right? Now, I'm over there. I'm getting texts from the dog walker each day on how my black lab indigo is doing. So, a little bit beautiful. Different.
Is it like Rover, or is she just taking that on her own initiative, taking pictures?
Just like, the dog walkers we have, they send a text every day. With the pictures, how the dog's doing, where they went.
Well, what type of dogs do you have?
I have one dog. I can't believe I can't find these texts. They're all over the place normally. We have one dog named Indigo. She's a black lab.
There you go.
Yeah.
My wife is actually, we just did the daycare thing. This is new.
Okay.
The last couple of weeks, so that she can attend veterinary school to become a doctor of veterinary medicine.
I'm a big dog fan. I'm a big animal fan, frankly. I'm a little bit allergic to cats, although I like cats. They like me. Heaven knows they like me. So
it's the glasses.
You got me there.
Oh, man, this is great. You're a lot of fun. So, like,
you're going to be fine. You're good to go.
Yeah, this is the show, by the way. Like, we're already halfway through.
All right, great. It's
fantastic.
Sounds good.
All right. So how did you, like, where did you get involved with technology? Like, where did it even start?
Well, although all of my software engineers and product managers would like choke on their coffee here, in high school, I used to code quite a bit I had a really good teacher, and I did a lot of what we called software programming. We certainly didn't call it engineering back then. And that was a long, long time ago. And then I was an engineering major in college, mechanical engineer, because I frankly got burned out in a couple computer courses. And then I was a submarine officer in the Navy for my first 5 years out of college. And I went through a nuclear tech, basically nuclear reactor plant management program, very heavy engineering. So I was always in very technical things, even though I'm not these days a software engineer by any means. And so when I got out of business school, after the Navy, I started out in software sales, but part of the reason I was able to do it is because I could pick up the product pretty quickly and I could demo it myself instead of relying on someone and so forth like that. So I've kind of been around some kind of technical aspect all through my career from college on, really from high school on.
So when you were on the sub for like all those years, like how long do you go at a time?
Well, I was on out here in Bangor, Washington, the ballistic missile subs, known colloquially as boomers, go out for kind of 10 weeks at a time on their deterrent patrols, and they come back and switch out crews. I was on a fast attack sub, kind of a typical sub that does other submarine missions. We never had a second crew. The longest we were out was not 10 weeks. Probably the longest we were under the water was about 6 weeks. Which isn't that long by submarine standards. But we were in 3.5 years aboard. We were away from home port more than 70% of the time for 3.5 years. So I was underway a lot.
Wow. And was that a nuclear sub?
It was a nuclear sub. Nuclear powered. We never carried nuclear weapons. We carried torpedoes. And more than that, we carried tactical Tomahawk cruise missiles.
Nice. So you would like surface and then that's when...
Periscope depth.
Periscope
and we did
depth.
Some SEAL operations, mainly training operations with the SEALs back then. It was before the days of a lot of the sort of global terrorism stuff that's going on now. But it was in the early to mid 90s. The Cold War had just ended.
So I'm a huge nerd and I was reading, and so correct me if I'm wrong, but I saw like some of the nuclear aircraft carrier, and that means that like they're powered by nuclear power.
Correct.
They could go like 120 years without refueling. Is that wrong?
Yeah, basically they've developed the nuclear cores now so that they last longer than the ship's life. So it's pretty, it used to be like my boat was, the keel was laid in 1972 or 73, and I was on it pretty late in life in like the, you know, early 90s, 91 to 94. But all of those boats had a refueling overhaul halfway through. In other words, the hulls and everything lasted twice as long as the nuclear cores. Now, all of the ships they're putting out, nuclear-powered ships and subs, are that the core lasts longer than the life of the ship.
That's amazing. I love it. Dude, I'm so geeky and nerdy. I was watching like Einstein's quantum, like, riddle earlier.
Don't ask me that. Even the glasses won't help there.
Spooky action at a distance, right? So what's Ekata? First of all, the name sounds amazing. When I hear it, it's fun to say. Very cool.
Okay, we call it Ekata.
Okay. So our whole team is wrong. For like weeks, like Ekata's coming on.
Ekata, we spun out of, I used to be the CEO of White Pages. I started it as a VP of sales and then a general manager of White Pages Pro, which was back in 2012, 2013. It was basically accessing White Pages consumer data that was on the website via API for business purposes. And so that business grew and grew. And ultimately, I was the founder and chairman of the board asked me to run the whole company, which was two business units, one consumer, one B2B. And then Ekata, we basically separated the two businesses, began to kind of diverge in terms of strategy and so forth. And so we separated and became Ekata. We used to be White Pages Pro, and that was relatively recent in June. And basically, we provide what's called identity verification globally for if you, Joel, are doing what's called a card not present transaction or some sort of payment via Venmo or PayPal or anything else where, you know, you're not standing at a counter and someone can't ask you for a second form of identification, like, you know, your driver's license or something. Our data is used to try and verify, is this really Joel or is it someone who's, you know, impersonating Joel with some of his data they've bought on the dark web or stolen in some way, hacked into his computer or whatever, and is impersonating Joel from a cyber fraud standpoint to embezzle, you know, or steal money in some way.
Is that happening a lot?
Cyber fraud is a growth business, unfortunately, for the world. And as more and more of the world economy moves online, it's a really target-rich environment. And especially in places like Russia and China, it's a lot of ways it's state-sponsored. So at a minimum, the state looks the other way. You know what I'm saying? So they're not going to do anything. There's no Federal Bureau of Investigation or whatever is going to break down someone's door in Russia and arrest them for committing cyber crimes.
Yeah. And I was talking with a cybersecurity person a few weeks ago, and they were saying that, like, we were talking specifically about how they'll attack computers and like take over them and then like encrypt their hard drives and then charge them to decrypt their hard drives. And they said that it runs like a business. Like there's customer support and sales, and like you can talk with them and they act like a business. And I was blown away by that.
Yeah.
So you guys are helping prevent that.
We help prevent. It's usually locking your computer is something that's a little bit tangential, but we primarily work with large and global e-commerce companies, online travel agencies, you know, think like anybody who's selling some sort of a digital ticket online. Almost all of those are customers of ours. And then payment companies, card brands, almost all of the big card brands and payment companies are customers of ours. And our data is just part of what's used, but we have what Gartner calls dynamic personally identifiable information. So static PII is like a social security number, date of birth. It's all been compromised. You know, yours or my data can be bought on the dark web anytime. Dynamic PII is things like email addresses, mobile phone numbers, IP addresses, things that change more. And it's harder for a fraudster to piece together all those things to make it look like Joel. They might be able to get your address, or they might be able to get your email. It's hard for them to get your email and your address that's really yours at the same time. So we try and provide what is really Joel out there. And a customer of ours compares what they're getting from an online form when you fill out a payment form or something, buy a ticket or buy a good. And they compare it to our data and say, this looks like it's part of Joel, but then there's a brand new email address or there's this shipping address that's been used 25 times in the past 2 days. It isn't not associated with him. That's weird. And so that's kind of how our data is used. And then we also have kind of a behavioral element. We hash and anonymize all this data, but we look for velocities and things that are sort of behaving unlike you would behave as a person.
That's really interesting. And then it seems like time would be really important because the transactions, they process in like seconds. So is that an important part of the business for you guys?
We have made a 4 to 5 year investment in reducing latency down from, you know, a second and a half down to 80 milliseconds for what the industry calls P99. I'm sure your listeners will know 99% of our API responses in less than 80 milliseconds. To basically move from after a payment authorization, which is called post-auth in our industry, to pre-auth, before a credit card payment authorization, because more and more companies want to decide early on, is this a good customer or not? And maybe if it is Joel, and our data is also used to verify it's you, we want to give you a really good, you know, we want to maybe give you an offer, an incentive because you're a repeat customer, a good customer. So we want to do that before the payment authorization too, because we might want to give you a discount or cash back or some offer to, you know, double before you actually authorize the payment, you know, what you're going to do, buy two of them or something. So anyway, we've made a 4+ year investment in reduced latency, and probably as a lot of folks listening to this podcast know, you know, when we were trying to reduce from a second to 800 milliseconds, cut 200 milliseconds off that, that's way easier to cut 200 milliseconds off of a second than cut 10 milliseconds off an 80 millisecond response today. Like the engineering problem is about 10 times as hard. It grows geometrically, not linearly, as you go down that latency curve. And so the amount of engineering challenges we have today, you know, today we're going from, in 2020, our goal is to go from 80 millisecond P99 to 50 millisecond P99 on our core products. And that challenge is like something we couldn't have fathomed 4 years ago when we embarked on this.
You're going to have to buy glasses for everybody.
Exactly right. I mean, these reading glasses that make me look smart, man, everyone's going to need them.
How amazing would that be, standing in front of your board discussing how you cut the milliseconds off? Oh, man. So at what point were you guys like, we need to divest this. We need to make this its own thing.
Well, we just, you know, when I came to what was White Pages Pro in 2013, it was a little 10-person business unit. And our founder, who's a real entrepreneur's entrepreneur, Alex Algard, my boss, he's the chairman of the boards of this company today, had kind of a gleam in his eye about a B2B business unit. It was 10 people. It was small. It was a $2 million run rate flat in 2013. But since then, we've been able to grow 50% a year every year, year over year over year. And we don't burn a ton of capital because we're not playing with venture money or the house's money. We're playing with the Algard family, you know, portfolio. And so we play it pretty close to the vest. And so we've been able to do that without just throwing capital at the wall. So at some point we had opened up, we had a pretty big operation in Budapest, Hungary. We were opening up Amsterdam last year as a sales and marketing office. We're opening up Singapore at the end of this year. So the Ekata identity verification business had gone global. Whitepages.com is a consumer business. It's more domestic. And so the strategies just started to diverge. You know, we were a lot of our engineering, as we just talked about, was focused on things like latency and so forth. 80% of our business is API driven, whereas the consumer business is all through kind of website and conversion rates and so forth. So it's just a very different strategy, and we were investing in things different, and we had gotten big enough that from a cash flow standpoint, we were self-sufficient. We for, you know, the early years, we basically had been funded by the profits of the consumer business, which was a more mature and profitable business. And so we didn't need that anymore. So those were the reasons that we separated. The other thing was just I ran two business units at that time, and it was just, you know, it was easier to focus when each business was separate. They could focus on the things they're doing. The consumer business is run by a really sharp woman named Lee McMillan, who I initially hired, who was started as a VP of marketing and then quickly the GM of the consumer business. Now she's CEO of White Pages, and she's great, and she can focus all her time and effort, her team's effort, on that business. So that's a win for everybody.
So do you target like developers? Like who do you market to? Like who do you advertise to?
We basically market and advertise to kind of three groups, product managers, data science, and sort of modeling teams and risk. And then at the executive level, either a chief security officer or chief risk officer. Sometimes that rolls up to the CFO. So those are kind of the three executive sponsor types that we have. But our day-to-day work a lot of times is with product managers or product managers and modeling teams that are effectively doing ML models for decisioning on whether to approve or reject a payment request or an order for a ticket or a good or service or a new account signup of some sort.
So there's just different parts. Like my mind is always isolated, you know, very segmented in my mind to like the SaaS type industry where you get Stripe and they have the features. But in all these other parts of the market, they're needing to build these systems.
Yeah, I mean, Stripe's a customer of ours, just as an example. But behind the scenes on their products, they're helping their customers decide, what payments are good and not good in a number of different ways. And some of the time they're on the hook for that. Some of the time their customers are on the hook for that. But they're trying to provide through the data and data science horsepower that they've got. They're trying to assist their customers on assessing good versus bad payments. And in order to do that, they run a bunch of ML models, and ML models are only as good as the data that goes into them. So we spend a lot of time on normalizing the data that we work with, this dynamic PII that I talked about, into model features, you know, ones, zeros, categorical responses, a numeric range where the model decides where the branch over point is on the range. But we provide that in a normalized way because, you know, most modeling teams will say, well, we're going to use our internal data first. And then they realize, well, the internal data is hosted by a different team over here and a different team over there. It was never persisted in a way to use as a model feature. So now I got to cleanse it, normalize it just to test it and try and build some features out of it. Then if that's the case, then I got to go borrow resources from this other team, this other P&L to build a service that will sort of store that data the right way and have a P99, you know, an uptime of 4 nines and a P99 response of, you know, internally 100-150 milliseconds just to feed my model. All of those things need to happen with some group whose core mission is not feeding my model. And in general, you know, we're sort of there and ready to go and pretty good at what we do. And so, you know, we help in that. We always call it a layered approach. Our data is never the only thing in a model.
So rather than them going out and building that whole section, they're just like, you guys are experts over there. Let's just use them.
Exactly. They sort of start with us and then build onto that.
Nice. So what does your team look like? Like, what does your direct report team look like?
I have a SVP of product and operations, a guy named Kushal Shahat. Awesome, awesome guy I've worked with here since he started as a raw product manager, but had been a founder, you know, startup guy before that. And he'd also spent a lot of time at Microsoft. I have a VP of engineering, Varun Kumar, you know, worked for Amazon for a number of years, but also worked at startups. You should kind of feel this yin and yang of a lot of people here are very entrepreneurial, but they also have some big company experience. So my general philosophy is that product and engineering should be separate. I almost never have to play tiebreaker between those teams. And frankly, I wouldn't be managing it well if I did, but there's always a healthy, you know, sort of yin and yang balance between product and engineering. And so I like them to keep them separate. And then I've got a VP of global marketing. I've got a VP of sales that reports to me that has a number of different sales channels. I've got a VP of account services and customer success. She runs a global team in three continents. Our CFO, Jason Englert, and sort of that rounds out my direct reports.
So I've been getting a lot of questions from CTOs about how they make the transition to CEO, and what sort of thoughts do you have there?
Well, so first of all, I'm a sales guy by background in technology, right? I started out carrying a bag in enterprise sales. So at one level, I'm maybe not like the best, I don't have my own career path didn't start on the technology engineering side. What I would say though is the more they can get outside the company, the better. Okay. Now we have seven operating imperatives here. The first is we build enduring customer relationships. And like, there isn't a person here that isn't trying to get to touch customers because I value it so much and our executive team values it so much. So like our VP of engineering is out with customers. Not a ton, because he's got to be a VP of engineering, but like he's out there. He speaks at a couple conferences a year. So just generally he's out in market externally. And I think that's a key thing because the market is messy out there. There's a lot of variables you can't control. Customers tell you things you don't want to hear. You know, you whiteboard something the way you think it should work. It never works that way in the market, you know? And so the more the CTOs begin to get comfortable with the variables that they can't control outside the four walls of the company, the better they'll be as a CEO, I think. So that would probably be my number one item.
Yeah, I love how you answered that, by the way. That was my favorite. I'm going to like highlight that and make a blog post about it.
Okay.
So you explained a little bit about your culture with it being some people have some, you know, big box experience and some people an entrepreneurial experience. Is that like you found that to be very important, or like I want you to, the question isn't well formed, so that's on me.
Yeah. But
I want you to talk a little bit like more about like, is that a requirement for everybody, or is that just a pattern you've noticed?
So I've been a CEO a couple times. And the first time I was 33, I'd been enterprise sales for a couple years, you know. I wrote a business plan, and it was software as a service before its time, back in 2000. It launched in 2000. Just before the first tech bubble burst. I ran it for 6 years. I raised like $26 million of capital, more than I ever meant to raise. That's not a lot of money these days, but back then it was a lot of money. It didn't work. It was a hard fail. Like I turn the lights off at the end. And I learned a lot from that. And it was a really hard thing professionally because I don't throw in the towel easily. And then I've, you know, been a CEO a couple times since then in various places. And so I had a couple of feelings when I got here and things I'd learned just the hard way over time. And so, you know, a couple of those roll into our culture today. And they're very kind of central to what we do. The first is we have one of our other seven operating imperatives called bring a point of view. And basically, I tried to do too much the first time I was a CEO. I tried to carry that thing on my shoulders every time, like we couldn't get, we were in the aerospace industry. It's a long, sad story. It would take me a lot of beers and a lot of tears to tell you about. But like, it was a market that didn't move fast. And so we just, when things weren't going well, I just had to raise more capital basically to try and keep the company moving. And I tried to carry that thing on my shoulders too much. And so what I learned, and frankly, a woman that was my chief operating officer for the last 2 years there really taught me, Carla Corcoran, was like, don't, when someone brings you something, don't like immediately have a response. And so I learned from her, my response should be, what do you think we should do? Like, hey, Joel, if you bring me a problem, great. But like, the first thing I'm going to ask you is, what do you think we should do? And what that does is it trains you not to bring me a problem, but know that if you bring me a problem, I'm going to ask you what you think I should do. So what that does is two things. Number one is it empowers you a little bit, right? Because you start thinking like, man, if I have an idea, usually like I'm going to get listened to, right? Two is from my standpoint, it gives me a lot more leverage. Why? Because I don't need to figure every problem out. I just need to ask people what they think we should do. And like 90% of the time, what we should do is like a gray area. It's not like a right, wrong answer. It's like, well, we could go this way or that way. And so if I say, well, gosh, I mean, I could like really think hard about this, I could do just what Joel says we should do. What's that do? Well, unless I've like seen the movie play out and I know there's like this really bad crash and a lot of smoke and like blood at the end, we should just let Joel implement his idea. Why? Because he's going to implement it five times as hard as if I tell him to do something else, which is usually about what the success rate is how hard it's implemented, right? That's number one. Number two, I've empowered him to do something. Number three, I've given myself some leverage because I don't need to worry about that now. Joel had an idea on how to solve the problem. He's going to solve it now. So I've trained my entire executive team to do that. They've trained their direct reports to do that. It's embedded in our company culture of bring a point of view. So literally there is a muscle memory function here that I've trained all of the leaders and managers and product managers on. We call them line managers here. Someone comes to you with something, the first thing out of your mouth is not we should do this or we should do that. The first thing out of your mouth is what do you think we should do? And it's trained the whole company that way. So as a result, we tend to index towards people that want to be able to be empowered. They tend to be entrepreneurial. I say a lot, like, you know, you put a wall in front of someone on my team here, and they'll stand back there and look at it for 15 seconds, and you start wondering, like, are they going to step back? Are they going to turn away? Are they worried? None of that's going through their mind at all. They're just looking at, like, am I going to go around this thing left or right, crawl over it, go under it, go through it? There's 15 seconds where they're deciding how they're going to get through that barrier, and then it's just go. And so that is the entrepreneurial kind of team we have, and we try to empower them. I don't try and micromanage them. We try and give them operating envelopes. I learned in the military a lot about giving operating envelopes so when people fail, because they got to fail to learn, but they shouldn't fail so badly like the company fails as a result of it, or we have some, you know, giant meltdown in our financial statements. So we try and define operating envelopes. So that's a little bit about kind of our culture and the types of people that sort of self-select here.
Woo! We're gonna like inject like post edit like a crowd cheering. Yes. Video edit.
Yeah, like, what you asked, Joel. Yeah. I can say that one without glasses.
What? But I gotta dive into that. What is an operating envelope?
Well, you know, so I'll give you sort of back in the day. So just as an example, most people that haven't been in the military think that the military is this top-down thing. You see movies and there's like someone barking orders and like, you know, salute, yes sir, no sir, yes ma'am, no ma'am, you know, do some push-ups, whatever. It's all crap. Like the military in general is about, hey, we're going to have small groups of people out there on their own, you know, finding their way. They're going to be on watch in the mid-watch on a ship. They're going to be on some mountaintop trying to draw bearings and do some scouting or something. They've got to be able to make distributed decisions. Okay. And so the military trains junior officers and non-commissioned officers, which are enlisted but have grown up through the ranks, to be very autonomous and make decisions inside of an envelope. So if you're a platoon, you know, leader, you're inside of a company of three platoons, but inside of that platoon of about 30 people, you and your non-commissioned, you know, master sergeant or whatever, in the Navy as a chief petty officer, are making a lot of decisions. And so they've got an operating envelope that's about what that 30-person team can do, how much ground they've got to cover, what their mission is for the day or the week. You can translate that very quickly into a sprint team. It's a product manager. It's a development lead. It's four or five people. They've got a sprint of, and here they're 2 weeks. They got to make decisions day to day on how that sprint's going to go. They got to do a retrospective on that sprint at the end. They've got to decide what the next sprint is, how they're going to bid the story points. That is a set of decisions that are made every day in standups on what I call here the edge, right? It's where the decisions are made. And what I tell everybody is the edge is nowhere near my freaking desk. It's in the sprint teams. It's out with the customers. There's people making decisions of what to say and not say in a customer every day. I can't micromanage that. We'll never grow that way. We got to empower those people. We got to train them. And we got to give an operating envelope. So in pricing, we have a really, really complex pricing matrix because we price across five orders of magnitude of volume. We have customers that do 10,000 queries a month. We have customers that do tens of millions of queries a month. Like, it's a most complex pricing thing I've ever seen. So we have a pricing matrix, but they have to be able to operate within that. So that's their operating envelope for pricing. But they have to be able to operate within that with some leeway. And so, you know, whether it's a customer-facing team with the customer, whether it's product managers and development leads, whether it's data scientists deciding when a model is good enough, like, that's a really hard thing to decide. Like, when's this model ready for release? Because you can always test more features, right? Always. Like, so some, at some point, you got to call it good enough. I can't call it good enough. My senior vice president of product can't call it good enough. They're not close enough. He's not close enough to it. We got to have that product manager and that data scientist who's on that model be able to call when it's ready for release, right? So those are the operating envelopes we decide, and then we empower small teams at the edge to make decisions day to day.
Oh, I love it. I want to come work for you guys. It's like, I'm sure people are thinking that themselves. If they want to find out more information, like, where do they go?
Ekata.com, EKATA.com. We're always looking for good folks. We have some people work from remote, but in the US, our headquarters in Seattle, we have a team in Amsterdam. We have a team in Budapest. We're just opening an office in Singapore right now. We've got a couple different AWS instances here in the US, and over in Frankfurt, Germany, we'll be opening one in Singapore middle of next year. So we've got a replicated set around the world for our customers and low latency. We're excited about our mission and what we're doing.
Singapore is getting really popular. I keep hearing it come up in conversation constantly.
Well, it's one of those places where, first of all, just geographically, it's been, you know, on the trade routes and kind of most, one of the most critical trade routes in the world since, you know, time immemorial, right? And it's at that choke point at the end of the Malay Peninsula. It's a merge of a lot of cultures. There's, you know, Chinese influence, Indian influence, a Malay influence. Great food, by the way. Everybody speaks English there as a first or second language. They're all super well educated. The government supports technology, and it's got, you know, a sort of a defined set of business law, which, like, right now in China is becoming very dicey for entrepreneurs and people that have made investments in China, because business law is just sort of going away, but not in Singapore. So it's a great place to be. Plus, we travel a lot to see customers, and it's a hub geographically. You can hop on a plane and be anywhere, basically in Asia Pacific region, in about an hour and a half. And we travel here to see customers all the time. So our team there will be able to get to Indonesia or Thailand or you know, Australia is a little further, but sort of anywhere in the Asia Pacific region very easily.
That makes sense, right? Centrally located, modern. No, and then I'm excited because I want to go try the food.
Exactly. Amazing food there, by the way. You can eat all day, every day.
So I want to talk a little bit about sales, because you have a sales background. You also got the geek tech background. I have a couple CTOs, VPs, engineering people that have been asking me, like, one question specifically was about divesting or creating a new product within their teams. Like, they have their normal core product that they're doing, and then they've been doing that for maybe 10 years, and they want to boot up something else, but they have to go, here's where it gets tricky. They have to go sell this idea of the investment to the executive team, to other members of the executive team. And they don't have a sales background, right? Because they're CTOs.
Yep.
And they have great product, great managers, leaders, but they don't have sales background. Where do they go look? What sort of advice do you have? A favorite sales training book or so? Like, how do I just get my feet wet with learning how to sell my ideas to other people?
Yeah, great. That's a great question. We talk a lot about this right now internally. What I would call that is change management. Because selling at the core, like when people say sales, a lot of people in their mind, they think, oh gosh, use car salesman, like twist your arm. Sales isn't about that at a professional level and not at a B2B level, internally or externally. What sales is like, hey, if Joel was going to make a decision based on some set of, you know, parameters and influences and so forth, and he was going to go, you know, A, like 40% of the time, and B, 60% of the time, if I'm involved and I can sort of sway Joel a little bit, and we flipped a coin, you know, we had to make that decision in some kind of a modeling exercise, you know, 100 times, suddenly with my involvement, it's going to shade more towards A, because that's what I want him to choose. Maybe instead of, you know, being uninfluenced, he picks A 40% of the time. If we simulate this thing 100 times, with my involvement, he picks A 55% of the time. That's a win, right? Because I can't make the decision for you. And by the way, if you feel like I'm trying to control you, you'll never do what I want you to do, right? But if I somehow give you information, I give you inputs and things to sway you towards where I want you to go more often. That's what sales is about. It's really about influencing decisions, all right? And internally, a lot of influencing decisions is about change management, all right? So internal sales is really about change management, because we've been doing this one product for 10 years in your example, right? Good Lord, Joel, seriously, you can't really believe we're going to like break this off and do some other product. Everybody in the whole company thinks about this one thing we've been doing for 10 years. And we've always done it that way. You know, how many times you hear we've always done it that way? And so if you think about change management, you know, there's a couple ingredients. Number one is, you know, you got to sort of build a coalition, right? It's got to be a little bit bottoms up. In other words, hey, two or three of my peers also believe we should do this. And that may take a while, may take them to lunch. You might talk about it with them. You might formulate what they need to understand to sort of be bought in. So you get a little bit of you got more than just you trying to do it. The second thing is, you may need some executive sponsorship. So, you know, if you're a CTO, your executive sponsorship is the CEO, right? And you probably need to soften that person up, socialize this idea a little bit. So like the first thing they see is not some frontal assault and some big meeting about we should break off this product. Rather, you just sort of been socialized. The third in change management is some kind of compelling, small but impactful either analysis or slide deck or something. I tend to like a 2 or 3 page, you know, analysis in Word, because when you do things in Word versus PowerPoint, you think deeper, right? But on top of that, you also need some kind of visual impact, right? So let's just say, like, you know, the visual impact is, hey, we've had this product for 10 years. It's been on a slow decline in revenue or usage or something for the past 3 years. And so I just want to make everyone clear, even though this is our core product, it's in a slow decline. And here's the chart to see it. So everyone's on the same page. We got to do something here. Like, sort of, you know, in the military, not making a decision is actually making a decision, right? So we're very biased towards making a decision. Any decision is better than no decision. And so So then once you've got that visual, then you've got some other visual of why whatever decision you're making is going to, because most people are visual and they'll remember very little about what you say, but they'll remember some visual chart, right? And then the last thing about internal is I call it repeat the message, right? If I say repeat the message here once a month, I say it, I'm not kidding, 200 times. Because whether it's with customers, whether it's internal, if you're trying to change something, saying it once will not matter. Saying it twice will not matter. Saying it five times might. I tell everybody when we're out with customers, and this goes same with internal, that customer thinks about us once a month for the half hour you're sitting in front of them or her, right? We think about us all the time, right? I know all about us, right? But that customer's thinking about us a half hour. While we're sitting there with them, and hopefully we're in front of them, because by the way, if we're, you know, talking to them over the phone, they're checking their email, you know, they're doing other stuff, they're multitasking, right? Which means they're not concentrating on us at all. The likelihood they will remember what we tell them the first time. Think about all the noise in your life, Joel. You got freaking your phone going on, you got social media, you're getting texts from your wife. You're getting your text about how your picture from the daycare, right? Like, I got to look at that for a minute. And all of that stuff's distracting you. So the first time I tell you something, the likelihood you remember it, 20% on a good day, right? The second time, it moves up a little bit, 20% compounded. So by the way, by the fifth time, you're not going to 100% remember it, but compounding that 20%, there's maybe like a 50% chance you'll remember it on the fifth time, right? So you just got to repeat the message over and over. And when I'm trying to change something internally here, I start to know I'm making progress when I see the eye rolls. Oh, God. Rob's going to talk about training and onboarding again. He's going to do an inventory training and onboarding by every team. Oh, he's in all hands. He talked about training and onboarding. And when I start getting the eye roll, I know, like, I'm making progress, man. They know the message is coming. Same freaking message, not a new one, right? And so, anyway. Build a little bit of a groundswell in terms of change management and selling. Build a little bit of a groundswell with some peers. Have some executive sponsorship, so you got this sort of yin and yang of bottoms up, top down. Build some kind of a short, compelling, analysis with a visual. Some visual that makes a statement of why we got to do something or what we do, how we'll improve things. And then repeat the message.
Oh, I love it. Dude, you're like straight fire. This is like a gold episode for me. Way to end a Friday strong. I don't even know what to ask you next. I'm all like nervous now. I'm like, all right, now I've got it. This has got to be a good one.
I'm telling you, we got started with the glasses and I just got on a roll.
I love it. They're magic, man. Okay, let's talk a little bit about product and like what you're most in the future. I think we're at a good wrapping up point. Like,
yeah,
what are you really excited about? What are you jumping out of bed in the morning for? Like, what's coming down the pipeline?
Yeah. Well, when we started here, you know, back in 2013, 2014, we focused on a couple of dynamic PII, personal identifiable information elements to help identify someone's address and mobile phone number. And then we added email and then IP. And more today, we put those things in models and we derive our own elements. Okay. So, and we work with our customers to get training data and, you know, we're compliant with GDPR and all of the things globally. We were very careful about being compliant with all local laws and all of the privacy that's tightening down and so forth. We anonymize data. We hash data. But we more and more are modeling elements, and those modeled elements are stronger signals for our customers to help make decisions on whether this is fraudulent or good, this person, this transaction, than just the elements in the raw. And so the more we can help our customers make decisions through modeling, the better, and the stronger it makes our IP. So I'm really excited about that. And then if you combine that with latency, we've moved into this what the industry calls pre-auth window or pre-credit card authorization window or prepayment authorization window. And it's a steep buy-in, you know. You're not playing on the 3-6 table in Vegas. You're playing, you know, with the deep pocket people on the, you know, $100 buy-in table, right? And so you basically, you know, to get into that, you've got to have a product that is up all the time. You've got instances on multiple continents, so that, you know, anywhere we figure anywhere our customers need to be, they need to see maximum 30 milliseconds of wire travel time there and back, and then an 80 millisecond response. And that fits into this pre-auth kind of 150 to 250 millisecond window. Of the companies in the space, One in 10 maybe can make that window. So we've paid for the buy-in, right? We're at that table now. And so now we're going to keep driving down that curve on the response time. And we're going to get more and more customers to understand why pre-auth is really important. It's really important for a really esoteric thing going on in the EU called Payment Service Directive 2. It's a long story. Most of your listeners don't even want to know about it, but it's some new requirements in payments for you know, card not present transactions that are going to drive a lot of things towards pre-auth. We're right there. We're right on the breaking wave of this kind of market movement. We're really excited about it.
All right. So I'm somebody. I want to learn more about this problem. I want to contact sales. I want to work at the company. All of that on your website?
All of it at ekata.com, ekata.com.
Okay. I love it. Now I'm going to give you one last question here.
All right, Joel.
Hypothetical question. So you're in your 20s, you're on the nuclear sub, right? And you walk into the other room and there's Elon Musk, right? And okay. He asks you to give like one piece of advice. He's like future Elon Musk. Okay.
Okay.
So he's traveled back in time and he's asking your past self, and you're with him, by the way. So you're like 24. I'm very clear about this. So you're a 24-year-old you on the nuclear sub.
All right.
Walk into the bridge. Is that a thing?
You walk into control room, control maybe. Yeah.
Walk into the control room. Thanks for the assist. Yeah. And there is Elon Musk and current you, like today with the glasses. With glasses.
Thanks for that clarification. Yeah.
Okay. With glasses and Elon Musk. And you're like, what is going on? You don't even know who Elon Musk is. Yeah. And you give yourself one piece of advice for the future. Just one. What would it be?
Enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people in technology spend a lot of time focused on the destination, which is some like big outcome or big win or IPO or you know, big exit or whatever. You talk to people who have been through all those and they're like bored. They don't know what to do anymore or you know, they thought they'd be really happy and then they're not that happy or whatever. But, you know, the journey is about getting up every day and, you know, trying to slay the dragon with the team around you and trying to make things happen. And I had a, you know, I mentioned earlier in the podcast, I ran this company for 6 years. I poured my life into that business and it didn't work. It failed. And in a lot of ways, it was a blessing because I learned a lot there. But I also learned that like the outcome was a little bit less than just enjoying the journey. And I get, we got investors and shareholders and board members. We got to have good outcomes and all that stuff. But what gets me up every day is not thinking about an outcome. What gets me up every day is, you know, we're shoulder to shoulder here, small team, super aggressive, innovate, you know, another one of our operating imperatives, innovate in dog years. I get up every day energized by the people around me and me and our customers.
Oh, dude, I love it. You're going to get so much outreach. Amazing culture. Look, I'm going to have Chloe book me to speak somewhere in your area just so I can like come hang out and stop by.
Hey, anytime you want to talk or stop by our offices, we'd love to have you, Joel.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on and hanging out, dude. We did it. We made a podcast. Is there anything we didn't cover that you want to get on?
No, it's just I've got to figure out, these are reading glasses and they're blurry long distance, so I got to get clear. I got to get clear, like no, you know, without any, so I can wear them day and night now, so I look this smart and sound this good all the time.
Yeah, track your closing ratio too.
Have all a great Thanksgiving, dude.
You good too. Thank you, Rob. You're the best. Right, see you, bud.
Care. Bye.